Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is Dr. Jim Lewis, the Director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of the nation's, and in fact, the planet's smartest minds on cybersecurity, to discuss President Biden's executive order on improving U.S. cybersecurity by improving standards across government and industry, as well as better sharing threat information. The executive order was in the works since the administration took office in January, but coincides with the ransomware attack on Colonial Pipelines Network that moves oil and gas from the Gulf Coast to the Northeast, supplying the region with half of its energy needs, forcing lines at gas stations all up and down the eastern seaboard. The executive order also comes after two major hack attacks that use software updates to penetrate otherwise secure government and industry networks, one by Russia via the SolarWinds software, and the other by China's Hafnium cyber unit that exploited a Microsoft update. Jim, thanks so very much for joining us as always.
Thank you for having me on the show again.
It's always a pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Jim, you and I have been talking about this executive order, which has been in the works, obviously, for some time. It's now finally public, and it says rightly, I think, that incremental improvements aren't going to give us the security we need, that bold changes are needed, and the government must bring to bear the full scope of its authorities and resources to protect and secure computer systems. There is a lot in this executive order. What are the key takeaways from your standpoint?
You know, it's really made a lot of progress, and it's a tribute to the new administration that they moved so quickly. There's three main parts: organization, best practices, and secure software development. Organization, it's basically restoring the cyber organization we had, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, defining what agency responsibilities are, you know, a process that leads to the White House, the roles of CISA and the intelligence community. It's a good thing. Best practices. I know that the people who wrote the executive order were shocked when they saw the reporting on SolarWinds, because some of the mistakes were absolutely basic. And some of the mistakes at SolarWinds, but also mistakes at some very big agencies. You know, people weren't doing logging of cyber incidents. People weren't encrypting data. So the EO puts in place what you could call cyber hygiene, cyber best practices, encrypting data at rest, requiring multi-factor authentication, requiring logging of and monitoring of networks. These are all good things, things that we should have been doing years ago. That's not exactly news. The third part is the most interesting part, because what it talks about is how to get secure software development. How do you get people to write software that doesn't have so many vulnerabilities and is easy to exploit? I was talking to the CISO of one of the big IT companies, and he said he looked at the code in SolarWinds and saw things he'd been taught not to do in college. So getting people to think about how to write software securely, getting people to think about where NIST fits in, and NIST will have a collaborative process with the private sector. The interesting thing about this EO is they were smart. They didn't go to Congress or any commission up on the Hill and ask them, please give us the authorities, because you know what a mess that would have been. Instead, they're using the federal acquisitions regulations and saying, if you sell to Uncle Sam, you have to share information. You have to show you're using these best practices, and you have to self-certify that you've done secure software development. So using the FAR is brilliant. And the hope is that, you know, we get Microsoft, Amazon, they sell to the government. Others, the EO, even though it's targeting federal agencies, will help move the private sector in the right direction.
You missed our cyber report yesterday. Mark Montgomery, John Costello of the Cyber Space Solarium Commission were on, and John Cofrancesco of Fortress. And we were talking about the pipeline hack and what the lessons were. We were hoping the executive order would come out because we would have discussed that with you as well yesterday. There were a lot of people who were likely Googling the meaning of zero trust after reading the executive order, as my producer joked this morning. Just very briefly explain to the audience what a zero trust approach to security is and why it's the right approach.
I actually kidded some of the drafters of the EO that zero trust was in some ways the buzzword du jour, but they used it, and it's a good concept. It's basically that you shouldn't assume that things are safe. You shouldn't assume that things were developed securely. We've seen this repeatedly in software. It's like, where did this program come from? Well, there's the prime, and then there was the prime asked the sub to write it. The sub asked a third tier company, and the third tier company went to Uncle Vinny in Mumbai, right? So, you know, just not assuming. Open source software, crucial to most of the products we have now. Where did it come from? When was the last time it was updated? Who wrote it? So zero trust is don't make assumptions about the trustworthiness of your information technology or the code that's running on it.
What does this executive order, from your standpoint, get right? And what does it not get right?
Well, it gets right to focus on software, and it gets right focusing on best practices. Those are things that we've been talking about for a long time. And this finally does it. It's got timelines in it. It's got an effort to, it gets self-certification right. And that's an important difference with CMMC, the DoD model, because CMMC has a third-party reviewer. There's some hassles with that. By self-certifying, you put yourself on the line if you want to sell to the federal government. So I think mostly it gets things right. You know, the things to watch are in implementation. So I think there was a little bit of struggle over waiver authority. Some of us said, don't waive these requirements, because we know of instances where requirements are waived routinely and repeatedly for years. So what the EO itself gets most things right. What we've got to watch now is the implementation. And you know from having lived in this neighborhood for a while that there are some agencies that are going to drag their feet. And so when they drag their feet, what happens to them? And that's what we have to wait and see.
I want to just go back briefly on self-certification, right? Because there's this sense that that's only as good as your honesty will allow. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, if business is on the line, sometimes people are very honest about it. Other times people are more than somewhat disingenuous, looking at this as saying, well, if I don't get caught, I can keep getting away with it. How do you address the charge that people will make about this that say that, you know, absent somebody actually certifying you, that opens the opportunity for mischief?
Well, that's one of the better parts of the executive order, because as we know, companies don't like to admit it when they've been hacked, right? And they will try and conceal it. And the EO requires people who have federal contracts to say when they've been whacked, right? And of course, if you certified that you did everything right, and then you have to come and admit, oh, by the way, I was hacked, there's some immediate questions. And one thing we should mention is there's a board that's being created, a cybersecurity board, kind of like the NTSB, the FAA body that reviews air crashes. So if there's a big hack and you have to admit to it, then you're going to be investigated. That makes it a little harder to say, cross your fingers when you self-certify. So that was pretty clever, I think, because we know that companies won't of their own free will always notify a big hack. We know that the investigation isn't a gotcha. This NTSB-like body isn't a gotcha. It's like with the airplane crashes, look at what caused the crash and see what we can learn from it to prevent future crashes. So it's that part. We'll see how it works. And it gets back to my question about implementation, but if it works the way it's intended, self-certification ought to be enough.
It's interesting. The NTSB model is very interesting because one of the biggest problems we've had is that both the government is too secretive about hacks when they happen. So basically, right, and so stovepipe that people inside the process don't often learn the lessons they should. And then more broadly, people aren't sharing the threat information because companies are afraid of revealing penetrations, right? I mean, they don't want to do that unless they absolutely have to at the end of the day from a commercial or from an investor standpoint. I mean, I think that's one of the things the Solarium Commission recommendations were that companies should actually report and be open about this as part of their governance structure. How much more has to happen, Jim, for us to learn and be open and honest, right? I mean, it's one thing to have an NTSB process, but at the end of the day, classification can get in the way of it. What's the right way for us to be sharing these kind of lessons learned in a much broader way? Because the devil is in the details. You can have the right idea, but it's the implementation that matters. What's the right way to make sure that we get the most out of this as intended?
It's easy to write a recommendation that says that companies should share. It's like writing a recommendation that companies should behave. It's very thoughtful. This is a little different. I think one of the things, SolarWinds really drove a lot of this. And one of the things that the conclusions was the government doesn't have visibility into private networks. We wouldn't want the government to have visibility into private networks because that might tread a little too close to some of the constitutional protections. But many big companies, most big companies have contracts with the big cybersecurity vendors, right? The cybersecurity service providers. And if you could figure out some way to get the intelligence community and the big cyber companies like FireEye or McAfee, or they have good insight. And because it's done under contract, they have they don't have a legal constraint. So one of the changes is that contracting in the future will have the requirement that companies can and must share that information on a hack with the federal government. The partnership that you'll see, this cybersecurity board, the partnership, it will have a government chair and a private sector chair, co-chair. The partnership between the cybersecurity companies and the IC is one of the biggest changes because these companies do have the insight, not total, but they have very deep insight for the places they have contracts with. I think that's one of the biggest differences. This is a way to operationalize information sharing, not just recommend it, which we've now, I think this might be the 12th anniversary of recommending it, might be the 20th. This goes way beyond that and says these companies know we now can work with them. And it doesn't require legal changes. One of the best things about this EO is it doesn't need much help from the Hill. And you, of course, know why that's a good thing.
Indeed. And I should also point out, right, that two of the key members of the administration team on this, and I mean, I should say more broadly, right, whether it's at the Cyber Security Infrastructure Security Agency, whether it's Jen Easterly at CISA, or it's Chris Inglis, who's the National Cyber Director, or Ann Neuberger, right, whether it was former Deputy NSA Director, and was doing outreach for NSA. So you have people who are kind of cross-cutting, Chris obviously doing work on industry boards and advising companies, whether it was FedEx and others. So really you've got folks who understand that sort of public-private element of this, given how much of the nation's cyber infrastructure obviously is in the commercial universe. Let me take you to the question of what's next. You and I talked about this a little bit when the president did impose some penalties on the Russians. There is an expectation that a lot more has to be done. Obviously, the administration is considering what to do with the Chinese as well, given that the Hafnium attack may actually dwarf whatever it is the Russians did with SolarWinds. What has to be next here, right? Because there are multiple discrete pieces of this. There's the ransomware piece of it, because this was a Russian company DarkSide, I think the company's name is, that was trying to extort Colonial. You've got state hands that are involved in the SolarWinds piece of it, and obviously state hands involved in the Chinese piece of it. How do we address that?
You know, that's the good way to look at the EO is that it's one of two parts. The first part is, this is the defensive part. If it's fully implemented, it will harden our defenses, make these attacks like SolarWinds and Colonial harder to do. But it will take time. You just don't sit down and rewrite code to be more secure overnight. So we've got the defensive side in place. The part we don't have is the engagement side, and that's where we need to do some work. They're moving in the right direction, but look, the Russians and the Chinese don't particularly worry about the American response. And in some ways, we didn't do as well as we could have on SolarWinds. I mean, sending the Russians a nasty note and sanctioning them. I was at a conference in Moscow, in virtually, of course, shortly after that. And the Russians were like, oh, another sanction. That's interesting. What else is new, right? So we're going to have to take some harder steps to persuade both the Russians and the Chinese to recalculate what they're doing, the risk of attacking the United States. There's a little reluctance to do that because people worry about the potential risk of escalation. I think that's foolish. We've been doing this now for more than two decades, and there's never been an instance of escalation. But we'll have to get over being gun shy, and then we'll need to start pushing back on the other guys. But we're on the path to do that. So I think things will be a lot better a couple of years from now because of this executive order and because of the direction that our cyber policy is taking.
Let me ask you about the public component of this. Americans now have been subject to an OPM hack, right? When the Office of Personnel Management files, millions of files were compromised of people who've got government records. We've had breaches of veterans' information. We've had breaches at major hotel chains like Marriott, which is one of the big three. So, you know, millions of records were compromised. Apparently, there was an Apple breach that may have involved 100 and more than 100 or 125 or 126 million accounts. Obviously, some debate at Apple about whether to come clean about that, if you believe the news reports and that didn't happen. Washingtonians and people up and down the Eastern Seaboard are having trouble finding gasoline today. I think it's a little bit of a panic. Obviously, if you need gasoline, you need gasoline. On the other hand, it's only going to be a couple of days before we reemerge. As you said, Jim, we've been going through this now for decades. What's it going to take for the public to sort of buy into this, to be more careful, to be more selective, to improve their own passwords, and to take perhaps a little bit better charge of their own cyber destiny in this process?
You know, I'm not a big believer in the role of the public because we're up against some very powerful and determined state opponents. So an individual or even a small company, you know, you're saying a small company versus the People's Liberation Army. It's not a fair contest. So this is state versus state, and we've got to think about that. I myself did not feel terror at the gasoline hack. It reminded me of the reaction that people had at the start of COVID when they all ran out and stocked up on toilet paper. This was panic buying, and people shouldn't panic, but that doesn't mean we're not in the contest, and we've got to find a way for the big companies, the big cybersecurity firms, the big tech companies that make these products, and the government to work together. I know you've heard that song before, to come up with better defenses, but more than that, we've got to take the action to the enemy side of the line. They're not going to stop unless they think there's some risk to them. And right now, if you're Russia or you're China, you don't think there's any risk. Why would you stop? And it would be hard for the average citizen to do that. And part of what makes me think this is, of course, phishing. Phishing is still the most commonly used technique to get into a network. Phishing is you send an email and it says, click on this link to see next year's bonus. If you send that to 1,000 people, you know, at least 100 of them will fall for it. Right. So we don't want to expect the public to not act spontaneously in ways that are bad for cybersecurity. We need to design systems that take that into account. We need to design protections, and we need to tell our opponents that the days of the Wild West, as far as they're concerned for cyberspace, those days are coming to an end. Do those and maybe we'll see some change. But consumers, you know, there's a limited role to what a consumer can do. Sure, you can all do good things and we should, I'm not belittling it. You know, we all know the sort of basic steps that you should take on your home computer, but that's not going to solve the problem for us.
When this administration is looking at also global protocols, Mike Rogers has been on this program, Angus King, Mike Gallagher, you, I mean, in fact, I should note that in your long and illustrious history is the Vossenaar agreement, which was an effort to control technology that actually worked remarkably well. What sort of a global, right? I mean, we can get into an arms race and a gunfight. Eventually, enough people will get burned, right? So that may change the course of nation states and how they act in this, right? So it's as much about our security as also deterrence. And an adversary feeling pain, economic, diplomatic, or otherwise. But, you know, do you think that there are the kernels of some form of global agreement on this? Or is there going to be a Wild West dimension of this no matter what happens?
Well, I feel a little bit of a sense of failure because, of course, we have a global agreement. We developed a global agreement in 2015 for all That's UN right. member states. It That's was right. recently re-endorsed in March by all UN member states. We have the norms for responsible state behavior. They exist, but there's a couple of big states that don't pay attention to them, right? And so the issue is, do we need some global framework? We've got the global framework. The debate has really moved to new ideas. First, accountability. How do you hold states accountable when they violate the norms, right? And that involves the attribution, not technical attribution, people get confused by this, but political attribution. How do we persuade our allies that we're not making, that it's not a yellow cake in 2002, but they can trust us this time? And that's still a problem. But you've got the question of accountability. And once you determine who is responsible, you have the question of consequences. What's the right response to a Russia or a China or an Iran? When we catch them, it has to be done with allies. It has to be proportional, right? And it has to be more than another sanction or two. So we're on the right path. We could maybe go a little faster, but I don't think right now, why would, if you were China, if you were Russia, why would you negotiate with us? You're pulling ahead. You don't need to negotiate. We need to make them feel a sense of risk to bring them to the table.
I feel like I should be apologizing to you because I think that that's the second time I've asked you about global protocol and you've brought up the United Nations, and it's right. I mean, it was an effort and everybody did sign on to it. It's just that two of arguably the most important nations are not abiding by their own commitments under the agreement, right?
Well, the
problem.
The March open-ended working group concluded by re-endorsing those 2015 norms. A much more vigorous endorsement from all member states, the creation of something called a program of action, which is UN speak for like-minded nations working together. We're on the right path. And so I think that, you know, the fact that people aren't always aware of these agreements, that's going to change. So if we push hard enough, we can make this better.
Jim, thanks so much as always for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Vago. This was great.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.